You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 22nd, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is Matt and Mike Mondays on
The Majority Report.
We are broadcasting to you live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dow Lunch District of New York City. Joining us today, two excellent guests. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large of The Atlantic magazine, will explain to us what the real unemployment numbers are and how administrations like the Obama administration like to deceive us on the real numbers. Also, Nancy L. Cohen, author and historian, will talk about Texas's latest assault on women's rights and Nancy Pelosi's new push to connect core economic issues with women's rights, plus a whole lot of other unbelievable things, folks.
Yes.
Also stunning.
Yes. Unbelievable also, and stunning.
We just got an email I just saw from this kid who I think has called in. He called in the show before with like the ultimate, you know, libertarian, I'm going to take you down challenge on Sam. And it was sort of like one of those moments where the creationist is like, well, the dinosaur bones are there because Satan put them there to deceive you. Owned. That was sort of how he debated Sam.
It's kind of like, you know, when they say, you know, we really have no way to tell when the earth actually was was formed and created. Like these rocks that you say prove a certain time period. I mean, we have no way.
But he was, that was one, but it was more like the, like, I got you, Cedar. You haven't watched the Milton Friedman documentary.
So that is more like the dinosaur.
Back
one.
Up. Yeah.
That is more like the dinosaur.
And he just sent this email.
I missed the email.
The email, and he said something to the effect of, I should have printed it out, but his line was, I really enjoy watching your show. You think you're so smart and informed, and you are so not. LOL.
I picture this guy being like, you probably think this song is about you.
Yeah, you probably think this email is about you. He said that, and then he said that Sam's clearly from his show never did any critical thinking or quantitative skill training. So, libertarians, get something off your chest. Please, we welcome you. This is our, if I could just find it for a second, this is our libertarian bat call, if I can find it. I don't know why I still find, oh, here it is.
Come with me.
This is our bat call to libertarians.
646-257-3920.
So
that
call,
is 646-257-3920. The phone lines will be open approximately, 12:45, 12:50. Just listen to the show when our interviews with today's guests are over. Call in, and that's when we'll start taking your calls.
Call in. We also have a ton more stories. A CIA CIA agent who was arrested in Panama and charges related to the Extraordinary Rendition Program. The Redskins were using a Native American chief to defend the name of their team. That had some interesting results. UK Uncut forced the shutdown of several HSBC branches in Britain over the weekend, and tons more. So stay tuned, folks. We'll be back with Steve Clemens in just a minute.
Yo, remember back on the bully when cats used to harmonize, like, yo, my men and my my women, don't forget about the dean. Listen, I'm the most a king, yo. It's about a thing, yo.
Feel
yo.
Real good with your hands in the air
and lick two shots in the atmosphere.
Looking for your friend, the one you let hit it and never called you again. Remember when he told you he was about to bend your mans? Yeah. You act like you ain't him, they give him a little trim to begin. Now you think you really gonna pretend like you wasn't down and you called him again. Plus when you give it up so easy, you ain't even fooling him. If you did it then, and you probably can. Talking out your neck saying you're a Christian, a Muslim, sleeping with the gin. Now that was the sin that did Jezebel in. Who you gonna tell when the repercussions spin? Showing off your ass cause you're thinking it's a trend, girlfriend. Let me break it down for you again. You know I only say it cause I'm truly genuine. Don't be a hard rock when you really are a gin, baby girl. Respect is just the minimum. But you still defending them now. Lauren is only human. Don't think I haven't been through the same predicament. Let it sit inside your head like a million women in Philly pen. It's silly when girls sell their souls because of sin. Look at where you be in. Hair weaves like Europeans. Fake nails done by Koreans. Come again. A win-win, come again.
Lauryn Hill is infectious, man. You can't use that for bumper music. You'll just start totally embarrassing yourself like I just did. Joining us now is Steve Clemens. He's the editor at large of The Atlantic Magazine. Hey, Steve, how are you?
Good to be with you guys.
It's great to have you on. And I should say again, as you probably know, this is Michael Brooks, and this is The Majority Report. So, Steve, you have a new piece in The Atlantic called Deception in Counting the Unemployed, the Unemployed, and you're kind of digging underneath what are the real numbers when we're talking about unemployment. We get these numbers released, you know, on a quarterly basis. They're political talking points used by both sides. But you're making the argument that these numbers don't reflect the real employment situation. So what are the real unemployment numbers, and how should we really be measuring it?
Well, you know, thank you for asking the question. It's great to get people talking about this. And the purpose of the piece that I wrote was to essentially argue that the official unemployment rate that we're fed each month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they also issue a number of other statistics as well, but the one that the White House, that members of Congress, that the media generally jump to is one that says that unemployment rate in the United States is about 7.6%, and that we have, upwards of, certain number of million people, 14 million people or something unemployed, when in fact the number is probably closer up to about 22.5 million people. And what I've been frustrated by is the fact that the recession that we've come through and gone through has been far more impactful, far more consequential, deeper, and dislodging, if you will, of the kind of high-wage jobs that many Americans had, that just telling a simple picture of the number of people looking for work doesn't get anywhere near looking at the broad trauma that the U.S. economy experienced. And even in those that are working, we've seen a decrease in wage rates. We've seen those that have lost jobs often gain jobs that paid a lot less. And what the figures that we don't, sort of deal with in a popular way don't show is the long-term discouraged workers, nor does it really show the picture of all those people who try to package together a livelihood by working multiple part-time jobs. And so you have your part-time employees, your long-term discouraged employees that just take themselves out of the workforce that aren't recognized in those figures. And I think we've begun to see in the media recently in a piece by Paul Krugman, that I had not seen when I wrote my article, but also Mortimer Zuckerman, who's the head of U.S. News and World Report. Many others are beginning to say that that this discussion of official unemployment just doesn't get the picture of how bad things are. So whether we feel good as a nation or bad as a nation, that we're looking at the official, you know, unemployment rate from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is a distraction from the reality of how bad things that they are for many Americans.
Yeah, so actually just a kind of, I think this is an important addendum or follow-up to that question. When we look at how these numbers are talked about, and I think you're right, it's getting a bit more attention from yourself, obviously, and people like Paul Krugman. But you know, these numbers, as you say, they come out once a month. They're obviously used in a political way to score points, win debates on the TV shows, and all the rest. And what I find interesting is that, and tell me what you think about this. This is a paradoxical position because you have the Democratic president and a Democratic leadership, arguably who should be potentially more attuned to these types of problems, although that's debatable about what their real record is on these kind of deeper issues you're pointing to. They're the ones who are pointing to this very kind of crude and simplistic statistic to promote a record, and rightly so. That's kind of their political job, obviously. And then Republicans are more likely to be kind of highlighting these other issues, but at the same time, their actual policy agenda wouldn't do anything to address these problems. In fact, they'd exacerbate it. So can you
you're raising a really important point, Michael, which is that workers are being abandoned both in policy and in our rhetoric about them. And it's disturbing to me when you think about a healthy economy and you think about what you need to put forward. One of the things that I argued in the piece is that when President Obama came in, despite, you know, in 2008, running on the fact that we had to renegotiate NAFTA and needed to look at work provisions, and he talked a lot about the jobs and the economy, we were also in a kind of a global economic meltdown at the time. And so the economic team that he brought to the helm in the White House were those that were essentially neoliberal macroeconomic type policy players, where worker level certainty was a microeconomic problem, and that they did not hire or bring in. There are a couple of exceptions to this. Jared Bernstein, who had been Joe Biden's economic advisor, was a noted exception to this. But, you know, Jared Bernstein couldn't carry the day in many of these issues. And it wasn't until the president was running for election again where they began to talk about a jobs and infrastructure plan that might have dealt with many of these issues. So there's an ideological divide, not just between Democrats and Republicans, but within the Democratic establishment on how to run an economy and what a healthy economy is. And the direction that in my book, the Obama administration took was on this macroeconomic side that really left workers and unemployment rates and, you know, the broad question of how to, you know, create job creation very rapidly in the economy that was seeing the air go out of it. Left that on the side. And by the time they got to that, you know, discussion, at least in their rhetoric, it was years too late. And so that we're dealing with. And it's why I think many people are now realizing maybe there were some policy mistakes at the time, but we also have a situation in which when we talk about employment rates, when we talk about how bad the problem is, we're nowhere near the level of job creation that the economy needs just to keep up with those youth that are coming into the sector today, or dealing with the fact that you've got many workers who are going to work for a longer period of time because they've lost their retirement savings or lost equity in their homes and are also living longer, which is a good thing. But basically we have too many workers who are looking for work and not enough of it. And we need to get some policy shifts.
And also quality in terms of those jobs is a big factor as well. And I think what's so interesting about your piece, in addition to what we've highlighted so far, is you write about – this is kind of through a lens of a guy named Leo Hendry Jr., who I think probably some people who listen to the show at least have heard of. And he's kind of the preeminent, I would say, successful businessman, entrepreneur in America who also is really quite pro-labor and understanding of a need for a kind of integrated economic development that really rewards and creates opportunity for a broad base of American society. He backed John Edwards, like a lot of other people, because Edwards, before he was kind of disgraced, really was the guy who was advocating on these issues the most clearly of any of the Democratic leadership. And you say that, you know, in some respects, in many respects, when Obama first came into power, this is exactly the type of guy who could serve a dual purpose of what Obama campaigned on, which was, one, really rebuilding the middle class, regenerating opportunity and creating infrastructure, and then also really working in a kind of conciliatory way because of the worlds that Hendry brings together. And then ironically, he was kind of shuffled to the side by the Obama administration because he was perceived of, you say, as being too close to labor. So what's Leo Hendry's role in all this?
That's absolutely right. I mean, Leo Hendry was, you know, a conservative business leader. He used to be with the cable company TCI, and he was the CEO of AT&T Broadband. He was the founding CEO of the Yankee Entertainment Sports Network. The people he hung around with were sort of Republican business leaders who were increasing productivity by firing people. And then as he looked at the kind of broad business establishment and saw job after job being offshored, and you basically saw the equation of concern for workers and working families and communities just go downhill, he said, this is going to be very dangerous for the nation, and we're really undermining, you know, the fundamental pillars of how an economy should work. And so he became very worker-oriented. He did advise John Edwards on these issues, and then he came into the Obama campaign as well, trying to carry that flag. And I think that Leo represented an interesting cross-section. When you look at what President Obama's message, which is to, you know, bridge different communities that didn't talk to each other, here you had a labor-oriented sort of former conservative CEO that was setting up by an example, said we need a new social compact for workers, and we need to have a broad national discussion about this now before it's too late. We need to think about education. We need to think about, you know, the areas where there's unfair trade advantage out in the world. And so Leo Hendry was one of these people there, and he was a, you know, prospective Secretary of Commerce or someone that could help on the economic side. But because the administration, you know, wanted to talk about workers but not be too close to the worker-oriented policy establishment, Leo Hendry was passed by. And I don't want to make it just about him, but it was this reflects a kind of behavior that we saw across a number of other areas, where the Obama administration essentially pursued and was much more comfortable with, you know, businesses that were offshoring workers rather than businesses and business leaders were saying, hey, we need to do something with workers at home. And that is kind of, you know, an unfortunate part of the Obama legacy, because I admire President Obama on so many levels. But on this particular one, we're playing catch up when we didn't need to.
Yeah, he almost seems, in some respects, the kind of business and civic equivalent of maybe people like Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman or Martin Wolf, who are, you know, economists and economic writers who are sort of cited a lot of the kind of path that wasn't taken in terms of investment and stimulus by the Obama administration. You know, heading into the second term, or we already obviously are into the second term of the Obama administration, you noted the rhetorical shift, which was very helpful in getting the president reelected. But now we're in the second term. You still see the president being pretty aggressive on promoting some very questionable trade deals from a worker, not to mention ecological perspective. I guess, where are we at in terms of, is the policy shift happening at all, or are we still sort of in the same position with a disconnect between rhetoric and policy, rhetoric and reality?
I think we've got a disconnect. I also think we're back, you know, sort of a deja vu period where we're back into the late 80s and early 90s, where we were doing trade deals with the promise of job creation, the promise of opening up markets for Americans and American workers. And that rhetoric, you know, sounds all nice, but then when you kind of, you know, look at the end of the day, what you've done is you may have pumped up the ability of capital to flow over to these other economies and to build, you know, to build export bases abroad that pump in product in the United States. I don't want to knock all trade deals, but the similarity between ourselves today, you know, when I hear the president talk about jobs, talk about training, talk about infrastructure investment, so much of it I agree with, but that's what he needed to do coming into this job, you know, 4 years ago when he had more money than God because of the economic crises that we had. And instead, we bailed out banks and financial institutions. We did not really you know, remove a lot of the debt load off of Americans who had unsupportable and unsustainable mortgages, and who also, through no fault of their own, lost jobs, because the way in which this recession, which was caused by, you know, a structural corruption, if you will, between regulators and financial institutions, cut so deeply into the productive economy, many people lost their working jobs. And in my view, basically giving those folks a square deal is something the administration still owes and still hasn't happened yet. And so now the president is talking about a lot of the right things, but there's not the budgetary resources to do it. And so what they do is they go to things that in my book are fairly distracting, which are, you know, looking at the trade deals with Europe and also the one in Asia, the TPP and the TTIP trade negotiations, as ways to ostensibly open up markets and to create greater efficiencies in the world. That doesn't necessarily solve the fundamental economic doldrums that we have, and the slow growth rate that we have in America, and also the inequities in distribution of wealth in America.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And I'm wondering, you know, you look at things a lot from a global and international perspective, as you kind of demonstrated just right there. And a lot of what we cover on this show is this disconnect between the kind of austerity obsession, maybe trade obsession, that there's kind of certain policy conversations that dominate Washington that don't seem to have much of a disconnect with the kind of vital needs of most of the country and building a kind of genuine broad-based recovery. And I'm wondering, is there a kind of global corollary to that? So we see Europe, you know, really hurting itself through austerity. And then we see places that we might look to, I know that there's been recent slowdowns, but places like China or Brazil, the kind of growing world, as it were, they're investing in themselves, and they're following
more integrated
paths.
China invests 9% of GDP in infrastructure.
Right.
9%. We invest less than 1%.
So, I mean, yes, please go ahead.
Which nation are you going to say down the road is going to, you know, investing in infrastructure, it shouldn't be done on a cash accounting basis. Investing in high quality infrastructure creates recurring returns for the economy over time, so that generations in the future continue to benefit out of that deep structural investment that had been made. And we're just not doing enough of it in this country.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. We just have one more question for you, which my co-producer Matt is going to ask you.
Listen,
hey, Matt.
Hey, how are you? Listener, Gaius Publius from America Blog asked us to ask you, if the same measure used in 1933 were used today, what would our unemployment rate be?
Well, Gaius Publius is a fantastic writer and author. I love reading his work, and I think that when they were out there, I don't know the answer to the question. So I know that when you know, labor data has been done for a long time, it's really great question. I don't know, frankly, I don't know the answer, that if in the 1930s that the measure that they used were only people out looking for work, or whether or not, particularly after 1937, when you had basically a cutback in government spending that prolonged the effects of the depression, where there's so many people had fallen out of the workforce that they ended up coming up with a more politically palatable figure. It's a great question. I don't know the real answer. I can just simply say, whether it was in 1930s or it's today or tomorrow, it is much more important from a policy perspective to have a fuller picture of the young people that are coming into the workforce, the elders that are staying in the workforce, those that are being trained and being, being shocked by the transitions in the economy. We need to give them resources to re-educate, retrain, that are serious and effective. And that when we look at those, you know, I used to work for Jeff Bingaman, the senator of New Mexico, where we'd have, you know, our profile of many of the people who supported him were Hispanic, single head of household moms, mm-hmm. working two or three jobs to keep themselves afloat. How do you measure that? Is that measured in the labor statistics? This is a world where we've got much more big data, and we should be able to look and slice and dice this stuff in ways that give us a more honest and real picture of the job dilemma that's out there, look at both in its domestic context, and then look at how it squares internationally with what others are doing to invest in their people. And so, you know, while Gaius Publius, and recommend everyone read him, is asking an important question, whether it was then or today, we should all want a better and more honest picture of what's happening with our unemployed so that we can develop better policy tools to respond to that challenge.
And we can't keep building an economic strategy that is sort of built really around the top strata, essentially. We need to kind
That's
of
right.
get back into the broader core of America, both, you know, for some obvious ethical reasons, but really it's vitally needed in terms of economic growth and our international position. So I really want to recommend everybody should read Deception and Counting the Unemployed by Steve Clemens at The Atlantic. Steve, great talking with you as always, and thanks so much.
Great. Thanks for what you guys do.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. All right, folks. So, yeah, that was really an excellent piece. And this guy Leo Hendry is an interesting – there's a lot of interesting kind of there's some interesting political gossip in that piece as well connected with Leo Hendry. But I really recommend that, and I think that's an important interview. We're going to take a very brief break. And then in a moment, we're going to have Nancy L. Cohen. She is an author, historian, and really a kind of thought leader in understanding the war on women and actually these connections between the economic issues we're talking about and the issues that really specifically hit and impact women. Matt is going to lead that interview, so we're going to take a brief break, and we will be back with Nancy L. Cohen and then, of course, the better half of the show. So a lot more coming at you this Matt and Michael Monday. All right. See you in a second, folks.
We are back. On the Majority Report, my name is Matt Binder, and I am joined with my co-host, Michael Brooks. And we are joined right now by Nancy L. Cohen. She is a historian, journalist, and author of Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America. Her writing can be seen in the LA Times, RollingStone.com, Playboy, and The Guardian, and many other places. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
So, Nancy, let's get right to it. With your book, it's called Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America. And, I mean, what we've been seeing with, I mean, just looking at the 2012 election is, you know, sex in America is something that's a big issue with these politicians who would like to control the sex in America. I mean, one of the big issues in just this past election, like I said, was, you know, with Todd Akin, with legitimate rape. I mean, there's a lot going on here, and it was pushed as this war on women that a lot of, you know, these conservative, Republican, right-wing politicians said, you know, this is a fringe of our party. This is like the extremes. This isn't the party as a whole. But I mean, here we are, how many months out now from the election? And I mean, women spoke what they thought about Republicans trying to control them. And I mean, this war on women that supposedly does not exist is in full swing. And I mean, it's stronger than ever, I would say.
Yep, absolutely. You would think that the Republican Party would have learned their lesson with women voters in 2012, right? Obviously.
Yes.
And, you know, we were told that the party was going to rebrand, that they were going to look carefully at themselves and come back with something better. Instead, we've got the same old stuff, maybe a slight change of optics until we got to this, like, summer delirium of legislating against women. And, you know, these people, they're like the zombies of American politics. They keep getting defeated. We keep being told that, you know, they're done, that the Republican Party is going to, you know, enter the 21st century. And lo and behold, 6 months later, they're back. And I think you hit on it exactly. They are fringe. They represent maybe, you know, about 15% of the electorate. But these sexual fundamentalists own the Republican Party lock, stock, and barrel, and even sane Republicans can't escape from their grips.
Mm-hmm. So let's get right into what's going on now with what's happening in Texas.
Right. So I think probably most of your listeners saw the, you know, the great filibuster by Wendy Davis against the really extreme law that would close all but five of Texas's women's health clinics. Some of them provide abortion, not all of them. It's basically a way of taking health care away from low-income women. Filibustered it once, Perry came back, they passed the legislation, and then probably something that most people don't know is that they have a couple more weeks to get even crazier stuff through. Mm-hmm. So last week, at the end of the week, they introduced a fetal heartbeat abortion ban, which means that from the moment a heartbeat can be detected, abortion would be illegal in Texas. Now, that happens at about 6 weeks, long before most women know they're even pregnant. So I think it just shows how extreme and out of step these Republicans are.
I mean, it's just amazing that, I mean, like you said, most women do not even know they're pregnant then. And I mean, obviously, then by then, they will no longer be allowed to get abortions in Texas. This also, I mean, affects not only, you know, women's ability to have an abortion but and control over their body, but also just women's health. I mean, there's a story here right in front of me that three Planned Parenthoods in Texas are going to close because of A, the bill that Rick Perry just signed, and B, a bill that was effectively funding cuts to the Texas Women's Health Program that was passed by the Texas legislature in 2011. Out of these three Planned Parenthood clinics, only one of them actually even performs abortions.
Right. Right. I mean, that's, you know, Texas has what I think the first or second highest rate of the uninsured in America. And, you know, most all the uninsured women in Texas depend on these women's health clinics for their basic health care. you know, to catch cancer early enough, but just, you know, regular health care. They don't see doctors any other time of the year because they can't afford it and they don't have insurance. And, of course, Texas has also rejected Medicaid expansion. And as you noted, rejected federal funding for family planning. So they're estimating thousands of unintended pregnancies and births. And, you know, tens of thousands of Texas women now will not have health care thanks to this law that allegedly was passed to protect women's health.
I mean, that there is, to me, is the root of the issue. I mean, this is a war on women, yes. It's attacking women's health, women's rights. But to me, it's also an issue of classism. I mean,
yes.
People who have the money aren't the ones who are going to be affected by these bills. I mean, these are effectively bills that are hurting, I mean, literally the poorest of the poor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And so I think, you know, women advocates like me and many others, you know, we are committed to defending women's rights over their bodily integrity and autonomy. But we're also a little tired of it. You know, mm-hmm. We'd like to move on to making progress on women's economic equality and progress on kind of life, work, family balance, you know, to make our families stronger. And so one good development among all this nastiness in the Republican states is that in Congress, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand are both introducing basically women's economic empowerment agendas. Mm-hmm. Pelosi announced hers last week. Gillibrand's going to unveil hers in the fall. And it's really, you know, attacking this class problem that you so rightly point out. You know, it's calling for reforming the equal pay laws, raising the minimum wage. Two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women. It's calling for affordable child care, paid family leave and medical leave, universal pre-K. And so I'm really, you know, kind of cheered by these developments that we're not just going to play defense. We're going to start playing some offense.
Hi, Nancy. This is Michael here. And I've been reading over a bit about Pelosi and Gillibrand's proposals. And I agree with you. They're incredibly important and actually kind of inspiring policymaking in some respects. And I'm wondering if you can get – I think there's sort of two interesting angles at this. One is they're both putting at the forefront this really broader understanding of what, frankly – you could call modern feminist politics or women's rights politics, which is at the intersection of all of these issues, class, opportunity, economic security. And then the corollary of that is that because, you know, look, a lot of women are responsible for providing for families, right? Like, that's the reality of today's world. And if we get past these kind of, you know, Neanderthal conversations on Fox, so that these issues are actually at the forefront of really anybody who's concerned about their own economic security and their own future. So in one sense, it's broadening the base of, quote, women's issues, and then also showing that women's issues are really everybody's issues.
Exactly, exactly. It's kind of like a gloss on what Hillary Clinton said back in 96, you know, women's rights are human rights are women's rights.
Right.
And I really think if Democrats make these issues a priority, they're in some ways putting forward a new deal. They're putting forward an agenda for the 21st century. And, you know, all men under the age of 50, these are things that really matter to them, too. They want more time with their children. They want their, you know, wives to have fulfilling lives, to be able to spend time with their children and have, you know, a meaningful work and remunerative work in their life. So I really do think that if Democrats can stop, you know, just put the Republicans on defense a little. I mean, we're going into a fall where we're going to have another debt ceiling fight. So I think it's really important that we have Gillibrand and Pelosi's agendas on the table to say, hey, folks, you know, they're holding us back, but we can really go forward if we can break through the, you know, delirium in the Republican base.
To really push that this affects everybody, I think it's also important to push that it affects everybody everywhere. I mean, this isn't just a Texas issue or, you know, a red state issue per se. I mean, these bills are making its way across the country that affects, you know, everybody.
Right. So the Guttmacher Institute estimates that almost 500 restrictions on access to abortion, birth control, and sex education were introduced by Republicans in the first 6 months of the year. The number of law restrictions passed is the second highest in history. And, you know, I just want to kind of go back to, you know, the title of my book, The Politics of Sex in America. Mm-hmm. The Republican who wants to be governor of Virginia, Cuccinelli, wants to outlaw oral sex. I mean, this isn't just about abortion. This is about, you know, you control women, you control men. These people are obsessed with sex. They have hijacked our politics for really outrageous kinds of issues. People want to move on to the things that really matter, the economic issues, the environmental issues, you know, the what are we going to do in the Middle East, things like that. But these nuts are kind of have, you know, hijacked our politics.
The supposed party of freedom, right? You know?
Yeah, freedom as they define it.
Well, I'm actually curious about that because I think, though, that there's some – I'm not quite sure how to formulate this question, to be honest, because I see headlines like banning oral sex and this type of things, and it would seem like – on its face, this is the policy agenda of some guy who's like harassing you for signatures so his like obscure, you know, like pilgrim party can get on the ballot.
Yes.
And what I'm wondering is there's obviously some type of real emotional problems and control issues related to this type of policy agenda. And I'm just wondering if maybe on a slightly different track, like What is the psychology driving these policy moves, if you could speak to that? Because it seems to me that that's part of the reasons that Republicans can't rebrand. Because if you're out talking about, you know, let's ban oral sex.
I mean, they can't rebrand because this is what they really believe. But this is basically the story I tell in my book, that these sex and women's and gays issues, you know, it's not a distraction. It's not a sideshow. It's the main attraction for Republicans.
Right.
And the right really had no base until they followed really fundamentalist women who were organizing against equal rights for women into, you know, they followed them, and I see this as all a reaction against the sexual revolution, feminism, and gay rights, and that we have to understand this kind of long 40-year history of how these fundamentalists worked their way up from the bottom to the top of the Republican Party to understand why we are here today. So a lot of it has to do with religion, but the religious politics didn't come about until people kind of freaked out about these fundamental changes in gender relations and sexuality.
I mean, we're seeing, to add to that, I mean, we're seeing in New Jersey, I mean, supposed, you know, centrist governor who's gonna reach out to everywhere. Everyone loves Chris Christie, but here he is for the fourth or fifth time cutting funding to, you know, women's health. And now there's Planned Parenthood locations in New Jersey closing this year.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know that he had vetoed the funding for family planning in the budget, and of course he's vetoed gay marriage. I think that shows you. I mean, do we really think that Christie cares? You know, wants to defund family planning? No, but he has to. He knows that there's no, the gatekeepers of the party are these fundamentalists.
He has to, yeah, it's the base. It's their party, exactly.
And is it really even the base at this point? It seems like they have such control over the apparatus that if even a blue state governor like Chris Christie, who I personally, I think he is actually fairly socially conservative, so maybe that's, you know, I think that sort of shows, like, and I think it gets to your point, Nancy, like, who's really in control here? It's not just, right, like, the base. They run the party.
Yeah. So here's a little fun fact. The Texas Republican state platform calls for outlawing consensual sex between minors, too. I mean, really. So, I mean, I think you can get married in Texas at 15, but if you're unmarried, it's a criminal act to have intercourse. No, they haven't gotten that through, but it just shows you the obsession. And so, you know, the path to the presidency for any Republican far right or supposedly centrist like Christie is through this group.
It's amazing to me because, I mean, this is the same party that will push, you know, gun laws don't stop gun violence. But here they are pushing these laws that are obviously not going to stop, you know, people from partaking in these sexual acts. It's not going to stop, you know, women from seeking abortions. But it hurts in the way of how these women will be seeking abortions. Women will still get abortions, but they won't be getting it in clean medical facilities with properly trained doctors.
Right, absolutely. And I think it shows that, you know, the concern isn't really about abortion, although I think it's that, but it is about controlling women. Because the fact is that, you know, if you look at the demographics of America, at times when we didn't have birth control or birth control was illegal and abortion was illegal, you know, people got married younger, mostly because mm-hmm. they got pregnant somewhere along the way. You know, so I do think they think that, you know, in some ways, you know, sex destroyed America, and if they can clamp down on, you know, if they can put the risk back in that, then they restore their Mad Men era.
Nancy
Alcorn. It's crazy. It's not going to work, but I think that's the logic.
Restoring the Mad Men era is the modern policy agenda of the Republican Party.
I think
it could not be better summarized than that.
In fact, if they started actually using that slogan, they might actually get extra votes than usual. You know?
Yeah, because all those people who like the outfits on this show are a little confused about what it's really about.
Seems like a really fun time, says people who aren't, you know, oppressed during that time.
Right.
Right.
All right, Nancy L. Cohen, thank you so much for joining us. Pick up her book, Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America. Her website, nancylcohen.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nancy.
All right. That was your show today, folks. Do you want to just briefly touch upon, Michael, do you want to just briefly touch upon, I don't have any story in front of me. I watched the president's
speech.
Let's briefly touch on it just a few minutes here. So on Friday, completely unannounced, President Obama came out and wanted to say a few words about the George Zimmerman trial, Trayvon Martin. He basically said how in the past he said Trayvon Martin could have been his son. Well, it could have been him. He said Trayvon Martin could have been him 35 years ago. I think for the very first time, really, at least not in a campaigning mode, Obama spoke about his experience as a black man living in America, how he was profiled when he was younger. He was followed in stores. He would walk by just down the street and people would lock their doors in their car. It's amazing that he did this. I do think so. A lot of people were attacking this, like, you know, if Obama cared so much about, you know, people, drones and this and that. And yes, these are all important issues. But I mean, whether you think Obama's point is to actually is actually to do something about it, it will no doubt spark conversation.
Well,
I mean, it's the same thing with when he finally started talking about gay marriage in this country. Regardless of what he did or did not do to actually make it happen, his words definitely changed the conversation in this country, and it definitely swayed people into, you know, being happy things like DOMA are no longer a thing. It's a thing of the past now. I mean, what would you say?
I would say two. I think there's three points. One is that what he said, just for having said it, I thought was obviously in some levels an act of real political courage, though I think it was also an act of political posterity, because, you know, not in a Pollyanna-ish way. We're going to have these issues with us, obviously, for a very, very, very long time.
Oh, of
and
course,
they're really
yes.
bad. But I think, obviously, there's a generation that he's speaking to, which at
that
least
can be affected.
That can
chain.
Be effective, that is more receptive to that message. I think the other thing that's revealing about it is I don't think it's really worth dwelling on too much.
The right-wing response?
I mean, the response to that speech, just to put it in context, it shows that – I mean, the emotionalism, the complete and utter inability to have a discussion of basic facts at, of race without either turning into racial attacks on Obama or emotional tantrums or conspiracy theories about what he said. Again, it just shows that there, that this politics is built on this really deep-rooted, emotional, irrational, fear-based reactivity. I thought that was very revealing. And then, you know, the other thing is actually that Eric Holder actually said some things in a speech, I think, at the NAACP, which were a lot actually tougher than Obama. So I actually – I think you're seeing a pretty good response from the administration on this. And I think he deserves – enormous credit. I think this is exactly the type of thing that we talk about. So when we're talking with Steve Clemens, or you want to talk about Obama, you know, the fact that he's relied on drones instead of serious, you know, diplomacy, you know, all of these things, which are completely, or Wall Street, you know, all these things, yes, a million different things to validly and strongly criticize Obama about. But I think when he takes a stand of leadership, which is what he did, and you see the type of just utterly grotesque vitriol that's thrown at him, you have to stand in his corner. We can't. I mean, I've seen people like Matt was saying, like, oh, the drones. I've seen other people.
You could be with Obama on one issue and against him on another. You don't have to be one of these people who are 100% gung-ho Obama, defending Obama for this and that. You could defend Obama for this and then be critical of him on that.
And I think for very specifically, because I think when this issue comes up, this isn't just about Obama. This is about... it's existential. The very existence of having a black man as president sends these people into such a fury. And the very reality of him commenting in a compassionate, rational, and commonsensical way about these issues sends them into such a frenzy that it's important on a cultural level to register support for him when he does something like that. And I think that's an important takeaway.
It's irony. It really is. These people calling him, he's the racist. He, race baiter in chief, I believe,
stunning,
is what Todd Starnes on Fox News said.
Stunning.
It really is the issue defined in them saying there is no issue.
That's exactly right. So, but again, I think that there is this part, and I think that this might be, you know, yeah, this is the cultural aspect of this. And this stuff, we can say like, oh, this is all distraction and blah, blah, blah. But actually, no, it's not. These issues are incredibly important. And when he takes a step in a positive direction and in a courageous direction, which he did, and when the response is utterly grotesque as it has been, it's important to register that fact and provide some support for that, because it is important. So I think that that's – and then, you know, there's obviously a huge policy agenda to pursue. And a huge cultural agenda to achieve, and I just still reflect on, you know, I reflect on the fact that, you know, the fear that drives this conversation and the irrationality and the racism that's still there but not acknowledged and not brought out of the shadows is kind of stunning.
And with that, that is your show. We will be going into the members' half right now. You can call this show at 646-257-3920. Phone lines will be opening now. You can IM us at any of our legacy IMs. If you're using any instant messaging service, you can IM us at majority.fm@jabber.org. Support this show today. Go to majority.fm, click become a member. You can support this show for as little as a cup of coffee a day.
Less
than a cup of coffee a day. Even extremely less if you're getting the good stuff.
That's right.
You can also, without any extra money, support this show by buying all of your junk through Amazon.com, through our Amazon.com link. Go to majority.fm, click the banner at the side, bookmark it, use it for every time you buy from Amazon, and we get a small kickback. You notice no difference, pay no extra money. In fact, some of Amazon's money goes to us, so you'll be taking away from that corporation you're sending money to, and they'll be sending it to us.
I just have to say, we're going to go into the better half. I just want one sentence. One thing I would say about Obama and all of this stuff, if you want to hold him accountable and the people who are like always want to be on Obama's case about something, he cannot come out and say this sort of thing and even be considering Ray Kelly for Homeland Security Director. I would do anything you can in your power to make sure that Ray Kelly does not happen. That would be simply atrocious and an endorsement of all sorts of horrific policing policies.
To be honest, I viewed that as Obama just not wanting to trash race.
I agree with you. I don't think that that's going to happen, but I would stay on that issue because it's important. But I agree, it's not going to happen. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the show. See you in a moment.